Position number 226, 21, Rule 3.
John Adams, Rule 3.
I had a job to find the motorbike when I went to look for it, really. It was all strewn with boulders and things, and all the vehicles looked a mess. They had the windows whitewashed and all over the place.
You were telling me how you made the camouflage. Can you repeat it again, please?
Well, it was a chalk quarry. So we got pieces of chalk which were lying about, smashed them up with hammer and mixed it with precious water. And slapped it on the vehicles. But we didn't stay long.
Why didn't you stay long, though?
Because the guards brigade or something had put the situation right. They'd come up as well, and we had to go right the way back to Medjez al-Bab. We didn't get any sleep at all. That was for one night and 2 days. And we couldn't go back in the same position again because it was already occupied by the Germans. So we stopped short on the road we'd used to exit Medjez al-Bab, and there's a complex of farm buildings, you know, about, in an area about half a mile by half a mile. And we were in the central one, and there were four more farms on the perimeter. And we were the only farm that didn't get shelled, so I wondered if they'd been spying for the Germans at all. The other farms, field regiment, 25 pounders, they were behind us on one of the farms, and they got shelled awfully. And while I was there, I got sent on two nasty jobs from there, because about a mile away, I should think, there was some French Moroccan troops, and they had anti-tank guns, and one of them had stripped the firing mechanism off the breech block and taken the breech block out, and they didn't know how to put it back together again. So they sent me along.
What happened to you when you did that?
Well, we went on foot. It wasn't all that far away, and they'd just broken up the AKAK regiment because there was nothing much doing there at that time. And I'd got their gunfitter with me. I took him with me. And we were under instructions not to walk straight across a field because you leave a track that can be spotted easily from the air. So we went round the field to this gun, and we got cracking. They'd taken the bits off the gun, the breech block and the fire. It was all in bits on the sandy ground. So I had to clean it all and put it back together and oil it and everything. And while we were doing this, a gun opened upon us about in a clump of trees about a mile away. And I rather fancy it was a German 75mm anti-tank gun shelling. And he was right dead in line with us, but the shell was going about 100 yards behind us and bursting. And I said to this, it frightened him a little bit, this chap from the AKAK. I said, he's only got to drop the range a bit and he gets us. But there was a heat haze, and as the shells came over, they kept landing in the same position well behind us. So there was a French officer there in Arab hut. They wouldn't allow us chaps into Arab hut for picking up lice and stuff. But he came strolling along. He was dressed up like General de Gaulle. He never said anything. He just come and looked at us for a while and turned round and went back. And when we'd got the gun finished and all in ship shape again, we set off back. Well, I went the same way back, round the edge of the field, but the shells kept following us. And there's infantry units in some low hills, and they were all shouting at us for, you know, getting too near to them. We just went back to the battery headquarters. Then another time, one of the troops had been out on the old road, which we'd been down before, and they'd been doing maintenance on the trucks, and the result was I don't know whether you're aware of it, but driver mechanics, they had a task every day to do on the truck, like cleaning the points and cleaning out the carburetor and cleaning the plugs and all that sort of business. Well, they succeeded in demobilising all four trucks they had, and they had to go along there. Well, we only had one driver mechanic. That's why they gave me the job, because the sergeant mechanic, he was either ill or something. He wasn't there anyhow. And we had to go out of the gates of this farm and turn right to go into Medjez El Bab and back down the road again. But when we got to the gate, we looked, and the bridge we had to cross over the river, River Med, I think it was, Medj, and it was under shellfire. So there was an alternative route. I said, turn left, and there's another bridge further down the road. Well, it likewise was being shelled. So I said, come on, we'll go this way. It'll stop by the time we get there. So we went through Medjez El Bab again, and we got to this truck, these broken down trucks, and the troop. So the troop officer said, we come to repair it, and started off on the first one. Well, we hadn't been working on them very, very long when the colonel came along, an infantry colonel. He said to me, he said, you know, the Germans are just down the road. I said, I don't. Well, he said, I'll have to get you to move out, because I've got a battalion of infantry just across the road there. And I said, I've been told to come and repair these trucks, and I said, I'm not leaving them until I've got them repaired. And he said, I'll have to shift the infantry lads then. So we carried on, and we never heard another sound. We got them all repaired. I had a blow lamp going to solder the wires that had come off and everything, and as soon as I'd finished one truck, I got Stan, his name was, to start it up, and it went. That's okay. Went to the next one, we got them all done and went back. But we're quite fortunate, really.
Was your own unit taking many casualties?
Not at that time, not our battery. Well, at that time we had a Canadian major and an American battery captain, because the American battery captain, Captain Shortreed, when the war started, when, you know, Britain declared war and Canada joined in, he crossed the border into Canada and joined the Canadian Army. And they were posted to us for experience. But it was not a very comfortable place to be in, because it was the axis of all the action in North Africa, Medjez El Bab. And there was Longstop Hill. Have you heard of Longstop Hill? And the guards kept taking it, and they put the Americans in to hold it, and they were driven out three times. Until in the end, the guards were so depleted, they had to be pulled out. And we had to get fresh infantry. Because the brigade were centred about the infantry. And the first lot we got, we didn't think they were very good, the Yorkshire Lancs. But we didn't keep them for long. And
what had given you the opinion that they weren't so good?
Well, they were mostly young lads, you know. They moved them on to another division, I think, and we got the Irish brigades, the Inniskillings, the London Irish, and the Irish Fusiliers. They were our infantry for the rest of the war.
What did you think of them?
They were very, very good. Very good.
How did your own work go at this time?
Well, the gun teams, they were forever sending reports in that there's something wrong with the guns, and I had to go out and see what was wrong, because they were after pulling them out of action. But mostly when I went, they used to chunter at me, because it was under observation and they didn't want the position giving away. I sometimes went as far as I could on my motorbike and then finished it on foot. Sometimes I just had to go on foot the whole way. But actually at that stage there was nothing wrong with the guns, they were just trying it on.
How did your comrades in the unit feel that the six-pounders performed?
Well, fortunately, they didn't have to deal with any tank attacks. We were a fortunate battery in that respect. Some of the other batteries got pretty badly mauled. But ours, we seem to have charmed lives. I don't remember any action they took part in Medjid El Bab or in North Africa altogether, really. Because it was ill country where we were, and the 78th Division became known as a good hill-fighting division. But we had to be there just the same. But what we had to contend with mostly is shellfire. And snipers, we sometimes got sniped at. But when you look at the countryside, you couldn't see a sign of any movement at all. You can hear the firing and the shells bursting, the guns firing and all the rest of it. But we had one sergeant, he was at the edge of a row of cactus looking through his binoculars, and some German from somewhere got near enough to throw a grenade at him. But he acted immediately, but he couldn't see where he'd come from or where he'd got or anything. But the Germans used to dig holes in the ground and put like a lid over it, you know, with all the grass on it and everything, and they could soon jump down and pull it over them, and you couldn't see them.
Were any of them caught?
No. No.
What are your next memories?
Well, it went on pretty much the same in North Africa. Towards the end, before the campaign finished, there's one of the troops trying to get a message to them. Well, a troop consists of four guns with the crews and everything, you see. And I had to go and tell them a message to come back in. But I never did find them, because the roads were thick with dust. And I set off on a motorbike, but when it came on to rain, all the dust turned, it was like riding on grease. I just couldn't keep the bike overhead. And of course, I had to park it somewhere and finish my journey on foot. But when I got to the place where the troop was supposed to be, there's nobody there, so I come back. And I had to push my bike back when I caught up with it. And they'd already come back under their own steam. So it was a wasted journey.
Were the conditions in Tunisia very trying?
Well, we never thought so, really. You had to be careful out on the road, because I had to go back to regimental headquarters one day. They'd got a new gun, and you had to go and calibrate it, which wasn't a very sophisticated method. I mean, just put crosswise on the muzzle and line up the telescope and just adjust the gun until it was targeted on a distant target. But I overstayed my mark there a bit. Instead of going and doing it, coming back to the battery, I stayed a couple of days because it was a bit quieter there. Well, when the colonel saw me, he said, "You'd better get back to your battery or else you'll be on a charge." So I come back, but on the road, I always used to ride, if I could, on a bike, because with the noise of the engine, you couldn't hear anything, you see. You couldn't hear aircraft, and I think on the way back, I had to jump off my bike about three or four times. Because I used to get behind a truck if I could, and they used to have a lookout, looking through the hatch for aircraft. And when I saw it halt quickly, and the driver and his companion jump out and run for it, then I used to stop my bike and run myself across the field, such as the fields were. And then invariably it was the Messerschmitts coming down, shooting up the road. So that's the only way I could see there was anything coming.
Did you run into the 8th Army?
Yes, we joined up with the 8th Army in the end. I'm afraid I've just been reading, I'm reading a book now about General Montgomery, and they're taking all the credit for entering Tunisia and entering Tunis, which is true so far as I can remember. And course, when the campaign in North Africa finished, we became part of the 8th Army. And in fact, we were with the 8th Army until the war finished in Italy. And I spent more time with the 8th Army than the 1st Army. The 1st Army was just formed for the North African invasion.
What do you remember about the end of the campaign in Tunisia?
We were on a farm. We knew the end was near, and we were on a big elongated sort of a farm, and there was our regiment battery in, and some of the infantry battalions, and the 17-pounder people. And we, looking away in the distance, we could see some little black dots in the sky. Then we saw our cat going up to them. And as they were coming towards us, you know, they're getting bigger. And they're about 6 or 7 Messerschmitts, and they're coming straight for the farm. So we, with all the troops there, we had about, I don't know, at least, I should think, 90 or 100 Bren guns, and they all opened up at these planes. You should have seen them all peeling off and scarpering. They all cleared off. And I don't think any of them would have got back to the base in Tunis. And then shortly after that, the 78th Division, they told us, was doing a triumphant entry into Tunis. And all the people turned out cheering. And they all had bottles of wines, and they're plying us with muscatel, and other drinks. And it was a real sort of hero's welcome. In fact, I nearly ran out of petrol, because we drove right across Tunis to the dock areas, and we made our headquarters what had been the Italian naval headquarters. And in fact, there was still an Italian navy chap still on guard at the gate. So the sergeant major said, come on, he said, give us your, it wasn't a rifle he had, it was a carbine. He said, give me your gun, I'll take you in. So he took his gun and run him into the POW camp on the back of his motorbike. So that was quite funny. But thereafter it was a very fairly quiet do, really. There's still some fighting going on at Cap Bon, which was
peninsula.
Yes. And it was a peninsula. And that only lasted for a few days before they stopped that. Then it was just a question of hanging about, waiting. But we didn't wait an awful long time before we went off to Sicily.
Can you tell me about that, please?
We sailed from Sousse. We went on landing craft. I forget how long it took us, a day and a half perhaps, it's not a really long journey, but we didn't know what we were going to do. There'd already been a landing made there, so it was just a question of landing on the beaches. We didn't know whether we'd have to fight our way up or whether there'd be any bombing or anything, you know, but that was the first off our boat. But somebody had laid this wire netting down on the beach, so the vehicles and motorbikes and things, the wheels would grip, and there were some MPs in trenches up at the end, like waving us on, so we just made our way, and it was all marked, went to what they call the hide. It was all heavily wooded country where we landed.
So it was unopposed?
Pardon?
It was unopposed?
So far as we were concerned. As I say, somebody else had been there and done the initial landing before we got there.
Do you know the place you landed at?
Oh.
Don't bother.
It was on the beach. It wasn't far away from Catania, I think. It was about maybe 30 miles from Catania. It was on the southern side. The Americans went on the other side.
So what happened once you got to the assembly area?
Well, we just waiting until we moved into position. We finished up in the at a place called Santurippi, which was a very hot spot. In fact, it was there we got one of the worst shellings I experienced during the old campaign.
Sant what?
Pardon?
What was the name of the place?
Santurippi. C-E-N-T-E-R-I-P, something or other. Santurippi.
What's happened in the shelling?
Well, it was one that had been... the engineers were repairing a bridge down at the bottom of the hill, and we were halfway up the hill. At least I thought we were, but we were nearer the bottom than I thought. And one of the engineers came up with a Bren gun carrier. One of their chaps had been wounded. And the sergeant major asked me to get the captain struck and take this wounded chap up to the first aid post, FAP. So before that happened, the captain came along and he said, "I might need me truck, you can't have my truck." And they had quite an argument about it, so in the end I didn't know who to obey, really. So Sergeant Milly said, "Billy, said get that truck and take him up to the FAP," which I did. And I think this chap was quite badly wounded. There's no sign of any hurt on him, but he was in dreadful pain all the time. So I took him up to the FAP with the driver. He come with me, and then we come back down the hill again. And about halfway down the hill, I could hear the shelling going on. And there's a captain, he went out of our division, he come running out of the woods, the olive grove at the other side of the road, and he was berserk. His nerves had gone altogether. He had his hands up like that. He said, "Get back, get back. You'll be killed, we'll all be killed. Get back." So the driver said to me, "What shall I do?" I said, "Keep going." So we kept going to our own lines and parked the truck. And of course, that's where the shelling was, our land. So we got out and I just walked over and jumped down the trench. And sometime about that time, the truck got a piece of shrapnel through it. But that wasn't the shelling we were due to get at night time. They were just ranging the guns on us. And about midnight, the same night, it was rocky ground. It was, you couldn't dig a proper trench, really. And it was on the not far from Mount Etna, and the opposite side of the valley. And come midnight, then they started then, and they did shelling. There was about 8 guns firing, I could count. And I expect there were 88mm guns, which are very much feared German gun. And they started at the top and worked their way down. Then they worked their way back up again. And then they come across from the left to the right, and then back again, you know, to cover every... none of us were hurt or killed, I just don't know. And our Patrick Clark, he got in the back of the wireless truck and he was giving us a running commentary. We were all lying on a row, a flat row, and on the ground, about 10 or 12 of us. We didn't know what was happening. And the battery clerk said, "Well," he said, "they're trying to bring the guns to bear on them to do a bit of counter battery work." Then he said, "Oh, they can't get our guns on." "Oh, no, the Canadians were on our left." "Oh, the Canadians can get them with their artillery." And he said, "They're getting ready now. It won't be long now, they'll stop it." And then the guns opened up, it was like a peal of thunder. And this shelling stopped immediately. And later on, we moved across the valley on our way when the campaign had finished. And we passed this where these guns were located, these German guns. And they were just to the left from where we were of this town, Adrano, on the low slopes of Mount Etna. And it just looked like as though it had ploughed up with a giant plough. All the guns were all twisted and bent, and, you know, they destroyed the lot. So we just passed through. But as we had to go halfway up the hill, you know, to get the road. That's where the road was, and the higher we went, man, it was July time. It was very hot weather down on the plains, but the higher we went, the colder it got. And I kept putting extra clothing on until by the time we got to the peak, you know, the highest point, I had my overcoat on, my greatcoat, and scarves on, cap comforter, gloves, everything. It was like middle of winter. And then as we got over the top and went down the other side, so we discarded them.
And you say that was at the end of the campaign?
At the Sicilian, yeah, where it only lasted about 6 weeks. I think what happened, when we landed, of course, we saw these Italian one-man tanks, which had all been abandoned. The little things, like these little Fiat cars. They didn't look very, as though they could be very effective. But we just went across to the mainland Italy from Sicily, from Reggio, was it? In any sort of water transport we could get hold of, ordinary boats and everything, you know.
How had the Sicily people reacted to you?
Well, in Sicily, oh, they were very friendly. Although there were odd pockets where, if you're driving through some of the villages, they were throwing grenades at us.
Civilians?
Some of them, but mostly they were friendly.
What happened to you once you landed in Italy?
Well, there's no opposition, not, as I say, somebody had been there before us, done any fighting that had to be done. And we landed on the tour of Italy, and we travelled right along the foot to Taranto. And then our division went up the east coast, the Adriatic coast. And when we got to Taranto, we stayed there for a day or two, and all the lads were buying cheap watches and all sorts of stuff in the shops, very cheap. But the Americans got there later, and they spoiled it. All the prices went up.
What did you think of the enemy resistance in Sicily and Italy?
Well, I think right from day one, I think they intended to vacate it. I think the Germans got out and left the Italians to do what they could, you know. Because we didn't get held up at all. There was at Sentiripi, which I mentioned before, the other infantry battalions had had a go to take Sentiripi. It was a strong point, but they were going up the road, and the Germans had a couple of Tiger tanks at the top, and they were blocking it. They couldn't make any progress. But when our brigade went in, the Irish brigade, they didn't use the road, they went down the bottom and bypassed the road, then come up the slopes. And of course, they took it in the end. But the German troops were fighting with the Panzer Grenadiers, and they say they were running about with grenades in their steel helmets, throwing them all over the place. They're right fanatics. But they beat them in the end.
Did you feel any hatred towards the enemy?
What, from our chaps to the Germans?
Yes.
No, we quite often felt sorry for them, and we used to say we wouldn't like to be in front of one of our own barrages, because we seemed to have more guns than the Germans. I think the Germans had used Duca dive bombers in preference to artillery, but we stuck to artillery. They put some terrible barrages in, I mean, 1,000-gun barrages.
Can you give me some details about what happened to you personally as you pushed through Italy, please?
Well, it was, as I said, We followed the infantry up and consolidated. That's all we did, really. And in case there's a tank attack. One of our, later on in the campaign, ours was a three battery regiment, each battery with 16 anti-tank guns. But towards the end of the campaign, they took a battery from each of the existing, a troop from each of the existing batteries, and they formed another battery, which